We were talking about the many worlds interpretation, and last time I talked about the branching structure and how you can account for appearances and so on. So that's what's one problem you have to solve, and you do that using decoherence. But then there's another problem, which is to account for the empirical success of quantum theory, which really means accounting for the Born rule. So the calculate probabilities being equal to the amplitude squared. In the many worlds interpretation, when you have this branching structure, you have the problem that everything happens. So every branch definitely happens. And so how do you make sense of probability when everything happens? And even branches that have an incredibly small amplitude, so an even smaller amplitude squared, also definitely happen. And so why do we use the amplitude squared? And so I'm giving you David Wallace's account of this, so David Wallace's attempt to make sense of this. There have been other people who do that, but I think what David Wallace does is the most interesting. It borrows a little bit from ideas of David Deutsch. Okay, so here's the idea. So first of all, before we even get to quantum theory, there's a subject called decision theory. So the idea is... so this is a subject in statistics, I guess. Philosophers would be interested in it. The book, the relevant book on this is by L. Savage. It's called Foundations of Statistics. It's nothing to do, it doesn't have anything particularly to do with quantum theory, but we need these ideas in the first place, and then we can move on to quantum theory and the many worlds interpretation. So the idea in decision theory is that probability is basically tells you how agents make decisions. Okay, it's kind of it could be a subjective belief that agents have that tells them whether they're going to decide one thing or another thing. If you're deciding whether to cross the road or not, and you think there's a high probability that there's a truck hurtling just out of sight around the corner, then you will delay crossing the road. But if you think there's a very, very low probability of that, then you would cross the road. So these sort of subjective beliefs you have influence the decisions you make. So what we have, the sort of structure, is that we have, well, what are called states in decision theory that I think in the context of this course, a better word would be outcomes. So these are things that you might see, like it could be in the context of quantum theory, a detector clicking or not clicking, a spin measurement measuring spin up or spin down. Okay. And represented by S, and then you make bets on these different outcomes or states. And a bet is sort of, I mean, it could be a literal bet where you bet money, or it could just simply be that you're betting that you won't get killed by a truck. And so the bets have rewards. So the reward could be cash, or it could be not being killed by a truck. So the bets that you might make, let's say a bet, basically you have a function from the bet on the state to the reward. So B of S would be the reward. But I might also just talk about a bet B, or a bet B1, bet B2, and so on. Okay. Right. So the next thing you want to do is to impose a bunch of principles of rationality. Some principles of rational behavior. So the idea is, if your decision theory is just sort of, irrational, incoherent, crazy, then it's very difficult to get any kind of theory going. On the other hand, if you impose some sort of principles that make your behavior rational, then we can start to say something. And so here are some examples of principles. And the book by L. Savage lists a whole bunch of principles. And those principles are sufficient to prove a theorem, which I'll talk about afterwards. And I'm not going to list all of the principles in this book. I'll just give you a few examples. So one example would be if B1 is preferred over B2. So this notation means that the agent prefers to make bet 1 to bet 2, and B2 is preferred over B3, then B1 is preferred over B3. Okay, so it seems reasonable that a rational agent should impose this kind of principle on their bets. I should say we're imposing a structure on these bets that we have things like B1 or B3 or you can have B1 is preferred over B2, B3 is not preferred, is less preferred than B4. We can also have the B5 and B6 are equally preferred. So he's indifferent to bet 5 over bet 6. So we have these kinds of relationships. And then we impose a bunch of principles of rational behavior. Another one is, well, if we consider this function, and if B of S, if B1 of S is greater than B2 of S for all S, then it makes sense to say that B1 is greater than B2. Okay. Seems like a reasonable assumption. Of course, not every time you say B1 is greater than B2 need this hold. But certainly, if this holds, then you better say that's true. Okay. So there's a whole list of these principles of rational behavior, and you know, each one of those you can look at and say whether you believe it or not. And first of all, you have to go get this book. So those exist. Once you have that list, then you can get a theorem, a representation theorem. Which says first of all, it says that there exists a unique function, suggestively called PR, of these outcomes, such that the sum over all the outcomes or states that are allowed is equal to 1. And also, they're also each of these individually is non-negative. And two, if and only if. I'll write this down. A certain, let me just write this down and then we'll talk about it. So what we have here is, this is called a utility function. And it's a function of the reward you get. It says that, I'm jumping a bit here. There exists a unique function on the reals up to this function is R. And it's unique up to unique function up to on R. It's up to affine transformations. Transformations like that. On the reals. And it's such that B1 is preferred over B2 if and only if this quantity here is greater than this quantity. Okay. So given all those principles of rationality, which I wrote down just two, we can prove this theorem that there exists an object that looks suspiciously like probability, and that there exists a utility function which is essentially unique, and this utility function and the probabilities tell you whether one bet is preferred over another. Okay. And if you look at this, it's a probability weighted sum of the different utilities. You can think of this as being, you know, some sort of payoffs. And so this P is behaving like a probability. So we didn't say anywhere that P was a probability, but now we get an object that is behaving like a probability. You know, if you go about your life and you have some P like this, you can make decisions, and you're making probability type decisions. You have your hand raised?
Yes, I can really see the affine transformation. What have you written? U goes to?
So where are we, sorry?
Point two, I can see the transformation. U goes
to. Okay, is a unique function up to an affine transformation. So this is a unique function, U. So, what's this? Excuse me. So there exists a unique function U up to an affine transformation U goes to AU plus B, and it's a unique function on the reals, such that B1 is preferred over B2 if and only if this is true. Okay. So does that make sense? Any questions on that? Okay. Okay, so this is all great. It's some foundation statistics. It doesn't talk about the many worlds or any interpretation of quantum theory as such. So now we want to try and use this to make sense of probabilities in the many worlds approach. So how can we do that? Okay. So we want to show that these probabilities in the many worlds approach end up being equal to amplitude squared. So here's the idea, well, these are subjective probabilities. We want to employ what philosophers, well, this thing that was coined, the principle. Okay. By David Lewis, a philosopher. Philosophers often come up with fun names for things. So I like the principle. And so this is the principle. Well, let me just take a step back. See, the idea is here is that we have these subjective probabilities, but we also want to have objective probabilities which are provided by physics. Okay. You know, so a subjective probability is some kind of degree of belief, but it seems like physics provides objective probabilities. So, for example, if you have something which is a radioactive atom, which is going to decay, after and the half-life is a nanosecond, and then you have another radioactive atom, and the half-life is 20 years, then it seems like a pretty good bet that the first one is going to decay before the second one. And physics, you know, actually provides those numbers, it seems. So it would be strange just to believe that you could work with subjective beliefs and that you don't somewhere in the background have real objective numbers coming from physics. Not that you can't. So Chris Fuchs, who pursues the cubist approach, does believe just in subjective probabilities. Okay, so but here we want to have objective, something objective which probability ends up corresponding to. Okay. So the principle says that a rational agent who knows that the probability for something happening is P is rationally required to choose that as his subjective probability. So if you know that the objective probability is something, then you have to choose that as your subjective belief. So we're looking for some objective property, which we're going to call the objective probability. And then because of this principle, that has to become your subjective probability. Sorry, that should say subjective probability. And so David Wallace, all of this is based on a lecture by David Wallace. He gives an analog that, you know, if you take some cash, so this is a Canadian $5 bill. Well, if you look at it, this is just a physical system. It's made out of, you know, atoms and molecules. Just a piece of paper, or actually nowadays plastic, but it's, you know, in some sense, this is also a piece of a physical system, or this. But we regard this as money. So why do we regard this as money? Well, because of the way people behave. It's our behavior with respect to this that makes it money. But this thing isn't money. You could probably sell it. This, on the other hand, is money. So, and it, we have a certain behavior with regard to money. And money in itself is quite a strange thing. But and so similar here, there's going to be some objective property of the world. And because of the way we behave, we can call that objective property probability. So that's the idea. And we want that objective property to be the amplitude squared. Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question about the representation theorem.
Yeah, go ahead.
The first point. What are the? I don't understand. Like, what are the conditions on this PR of S? It just says there's a unique function on the states that sums to one.
Yeah. unique non-negative function that.
I'm not sure what that means. Like, I can.
So you start off with a long list of principles, okay, concerning ambiguities, and it has to be, this list has to be, have enough principles in it, different principles of rational behavior, as they're called. And once you've got that, you can now put a function on the states, or the outcomes, let's call them, which has those properties, and it's such that B1 is greater than B2, if and only if this inequality holds.
So you need both parts of the theorem together, like.
And what gives meaning to P is this here, that it tells you how to order bets. So you might just start off with a whole bunch of different bets, and you know, you say, okay, I'm gonna, without thinking about it too much, I'm gonna sort of, you know, place them in an order. Either one is bigger than the other, or they're different to which one I have. So you have this long list of bets. That list has to satisfy these rationality principles, and then you go through the theorem in the book, and then the theorem tells you that this is true. Okay, so that there is some quantity that behaves like a probability with regard to, you know, how you make decisions.
Okay.
So that's the idea. Yeah, go ahead.
Is that set of which S is a member, the set of beliefs by one person or by all people?
Sorry, you said that there was the clause there of which S is a member?
In part one, we have a summation, S belongs to capital S.
Oh, right. So so these are actually, the S's are outcomes, things that you might see, like a detector clicking or not clicking, like a red light flashing or a blue light flashing. And then the idea is that you have all the possible events.
Okay, they belong by one person, by all people.
Okay. I think as the theorem is described, it's enough that one person has this. I think in typical applications, you might imagine that there's some agreement as to what S is, but I don't think that is necessary to prove this representation theorem. Okay. Okay, so. Okay, good. So now. So what David Wallace wants to do now is prove that the physical property is in fact the amplitude squared, the physical property that you use to calculate this PR function is the amplitude squared. And so in his paper, he has a bunch of axioms that apply information theoretic ideas to the branching structure. And I'm not going to give you those ideas. I'm just going to give you a very simplified picture. And then what he tries to prove is he proves two things. First of all, what he calls an equivalence rule. He proves that if two events have the same weight, so same amplitude squared, then agents are rationally required to give them the same probability. It's enough to say amplitude, modulus of the amplitude. So this is the equivalent rule. In his talk, he has a description of how that proof works. I'll give you an abbreviated proof, which he provides somewhere else. So the proof I'm going to give you is a sort of a simplified proof that doesn't capture all the essentials, but it's enough to get the idea. Once you have this, and this in some sense is the difficult bit, then you prove that the equivalence rule implies the Born rule. The Born rule is that probabilities are equal to the amplitude squared. Okay. So let me try to give you an idea of how this works. So imagine we have a spin half particle, for example, which is prepared in that state. And then we have an agent and a measuring apparatus. Okay. And now the agent has a chance to bet on the outcome of the measurement of this spin half particle. And they can bet, let's say they bet $1, and they can bet on the case where you get a spin up or the case where you get a spin down. Okay. So, if it goes against you, you just get nothing. So it's quite a good bet, actually. So if they bet on spin up, then the state evolves. I think I'm abbreviating this. Maybe I should spell this out more carefully. Sorry about this. So what's happened here is if you get spin up, then the agent gets $1. Let's call it one. And if you get spin down, the agent gets $0. And you can also consider what happens if you bet on spin down. the same kind of thing. Okay. And now I want to just make an extra simplifying step, which isn't necessary. But you know, in his talk, David Wallace spends quite a long time going over the more complicated arguments. So the simplifying step is to imagine that you allow yourself to perform a controlled unitary on the on this couple here, on the apparatus and the physical system that send it to a certain junk state. Okay. So let's just. So it's actually controlled on everything. So this is actually controlled on the bet outcome as well. So I'll just write down what I want, and then I'll explain what the controlled unitary does. So what this controlled unitary does is it looks at the bet outcome that the agent got $1, and then conditioned on that, it sends the other part of the state into a certain state, which we're just going to call the junk state. Okay. So this is what we get in the end. We can always send this to a junk state because this term here remains orthogonal to this term here. Okay, so what I've described is a unitary transformation. It's not a very physical unitary transformation because it requires controlling on the outcome of a bet, which is a macroscopic thing. Just for the moment, I think that doesn't matter. It's just to illustrate the point, and then you can go and look at David's talk and see the finer details of how to do it without this controlled unitary. And we can do the same thing also to this one, although we choose a slightly different controlled unitary. So now we want to choose it so that controlled on the zero, this thing goes to the junk state. Okay, so this is also a controlled unitary. It looks to see what the bet outcome was, the payment, and then it sends these two things to the same junk state as before. Okay, so it's a different controlled unitary, but it does the same thing. And what you have now here is two states which are very similar. The only difference between them is the alpha and the beta. Okay, other than that, they're the same. And if alpha is equal to beta, remember we're interested in the proving the equivalence rule, which is where the amplitudes are equal. Then those two states are the same thing. In this set of assumptions for axioms that apply to the branching structure, Wallace wants to assume that if you have the same physical state, afterwards, then that should correspond to the same objective probability. Okay. Because there isn't really anything to choose between those two situations in terms of making a bet. At the end, you end up in the same physical state. So how could you preference one bet over the other if at the end of the day you have the same physical situation? So I gave a simplified version where you have this controlled U or the controlled U prime. You can give a more careful version where you end up having the junk states are labeled by I's and J's. And then you have to make an argument that it doesn't really matter what the junk state is, that the bet should not be so much concerned with what the junk state is as other aspects of the wave function. And so then he comes to the same conclusion. Okay, so so now we have this is we have the equivalence rule that if alpha, I should really say, if alpha is equal to beta, then we have the same physical state. There's a question. Yeah, go ahead.
I have two questions. So, first of all, what is the difference between the controlled unitaries?
You can just look at them. The first control unitary acts on plus spin up and $1 to send it to the junk state, whereas the second one acts on plus spin up and $0 to send it to the same junk state. So they're different unitaries, but they're both controlled unitaries.
Okay.
Yeah. What's your other question?
Second question, so how do you conclude about magnitude alpha? So I understood when it was alpha.
Yeah. It's a good question. Well, certainly, if that were true, then it would also imply that if the magnitudes are equal, then it's also true. Wallace is very careful, so he would have answered this question somewhere in what his writing. I don't remember how he answers this question. The way I would answer it if I was to attempt this was I'd say that the ontology just at the very beginning when I said the ontology is the wave function I would have said that's up to overall phase. And so the overall phase isn't really a part of the physics. It's only the. That's my answer. I'm not sure what Wallace would say.
Can you make those one unitary by simply multiplying them together? The one would do nothing on one, and it would change the other.
I think the unitary you apply first. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Do they commute?
I think they don't commute because. You know, I'm not sure. Maybe that's the case.
It would be nice if you had one unitary rather than
two. I mean, in any case, this is kind of a toy example just to show you the argument. But really, the real argument involves being more careful and not applying this unitary because it's very unphysical. You couldn't really do that. So then the second part of the... what's where I was now? There. Prove that... the equivalence rule implies the Born rule. So I just that's relatively straightforward. I think this part certainly many people have used something like this, like David Deutsch might have been the first person. So let's just give a different example. Imagine you start off with a state which is 2 plus 1 times minus. So that's your original state. With some appropriate normalization. And then you have whatever, some other stuff. So S is just representing all the other stuff. S is actually an auxiliary system, sorry. And then you also have all the other stuff, with the agent and the measurement operators. But before we get to that, just consider this. So you introduce an ancillary system. auxiliary system. And now I can evolve it so that using a unitary, so it goes to that state. So what I've done is I've simply in the case where it's a plus, it's caused the system S to say to be transformed into a superposition of some set of orthogonal states A and B. We want A, B, and S all to be orthogonal, and then in the case where it's minus, it's just left the system unchanged. So you can certainly do that using a unitary transformation. And now, and sorry, and I made a mistake, that should be a 1. Okay, is that clear? And now you have equal amplitudes in front of the two plus terms, and also incidentally in front of the minus term. So all of these have equal amplitudes, and you can apply the same argument. You'll notice nothing really about the argument as I applied it required only 2 terms. I could have had 3 terms and just looked at 2 of them. And so now you get that the probability here, the probability of this and the probability of this are both equal, and likewise this. So the probability, if the probability is summed to 1, then the probabilities of each of these separately should be 1/3. Sorry, I'm just momentarily mystified by what's going on here. Yeah, I made a. This should be 1/√2. Okay. I made a 2. Okay. Okay, so the amplitude in front of this term and this term are equal now after this manipulation, and so now you can make an argument that the total probability for these two things is the total probability of plus is just the sum of those equal amplitudes. So you can start to build up a picture, even if you don't have equal amplitudes, you can start to get these equal amplitudes. So he leverages that to get to the Born rule. Okay. And the details are in the paper. Okay. Okay, well that's kind of it. So so what he's done is he started with the whole story is the world is described by the wave function, it evolves in time. Then we have this branching structure, which is something at a quasi-classical level. It's not something that's there deep in the fundamental description. And so that gives us the branching structure. Then we want to make decisions based on that branching structure. Decision theory is also something that lives at this higher level. It's like studying tigers. It's a higher level way of thinking. But you want your decisions to be subject to some principles of rationality. So you end up getting this idea that there is a probability. But that probability should correspond to something objective in the physical world. So we want this principle. If we can find some objective property in the physical world that looks like it should be probability, then we can use that, and that should be the probability. And then we have this argument to say, the thing that works is the amplitude squared. Okay, so that's the basic structure of the argument. You might have tried something else. You might have said instead of using the amplitude squared, let's just count the number of worlds. So remember I had this picture before. Imagine if you have a a spin half system, you make a measurement, you get this outcome or this outcome. Let's imagine, for the sake of simplicity, it's simply it's a spin, it's a measurement, it's one like this. And then you would just count, or you could actually, yeah, you could count, you could say, well, here I have one world, another world, so I have two worlds, so I'm just going to say the probability is a half for each one. Okay. And I mean, this, for this particular state, that would work. I mean, that would correspond to quantum theory. But then instead, you could say, no, what I'm going to do is, if I get this outcome, I'm going to make a further measurement. But if I get this outcome, I won't. And so now I have three worlds. So really, if I apply my principle that I count the number of worlds, 1, 2, 3, I should give probability 1/3 to each of them. So that's a different answer. And there's a kind of incoherence. It's not clear. It's not clear whether you should apply the principle here or to some larger chunk. So as a way of allotting probabilities, it's problematic. Okay. So that's kind of what I want to say about probability in a many worlds approach. Let me just give a few criticisms, and then I'll finish this particular topic. Okay, I need another blackboard. Here. So first of all, this story I just told you about probabilities, I think there's a general view in the community that while it is a very impressive attempt, it does something that is quite remarkable in that it takes a fundamental property, which isn't necessarily anything to do with probability, and tells and attempts to persuade you that that thing should behave as probability, should be used as probability by agents. So so probability emerges as a concept rather than being there in the fundamental axioms of the theory. Nevertheless, a lot of people have criticized it. You can just say, well, I don't accept, you know, whatever, you don't accept the various axioms that have been used to obtain this, and then you can write down some alternative answer. And really, there isn't anything that David Wallace can do about that other than argue that his approach is better. And there's various people have proposed alternatives or criticisms of this approach. There was a conference at Perimeter in 2007. This is the collection number for that conference. There was another conference in Oxford at the same time. Not exactly the same time, like a week or so later, perhaps. And at this conference here, you can find all the talks. Lots of people spoke, and there were various criticisms. Adrian Kent, David Albert, Hugh Price, and others actually gave criticisms, picked holes in this approach to probability. So certainly not something where there is consensus, and I think probability is really still a deep problem for the many worlds approach. It's also, incidentally, a deep problem in philosophy anyway. What is the correct interpretation of probability is a deep problem in any case. David Wallace would say, well, it's a deep problem in generally, but we have a much better understanding of probability in the context of the many worlds than anyone else does. So yeah, so there's that. The second criticism is that the many worlds approach is that it's distasteful. So a number of years back, I was explaining the many worlds approach to my wife, and we were having a nice dinner at a restaurant, and she told me to stop speaking about it because it was putting her off her meal. And I think that's a very natural reaction, because if you really have a visceral understanding of what this approach is saying, it's saying that pretty much anything that can happen actually definitely does happen, is happening all the time. And if you do a full quantum field theoretic treatment, then there are essentially non-zero probabilities for pretty much anything. And so anything you can imagine, any terrible thing that's happening in this room that you can imagine, and well, you may already say this is pretty terrible, but there's a lot worse things that could be happening in this room. Just suddenly, instantaneous, any time. And they definitely are happening in the many worlds approach. Even if they have a small amplitude, so what? They're definitely happening. That's a concern. And incidentally, you know, if you really believe this, if you really believe all these terrible things are happening, then it might even impact on this. You know, if I have a choice to cross the road, and the probability of getting hit by a car is incredibly small, in the many worlds interpretation, I know for certain that I will get hit by a car. Okay, that definitely will happen. Whereas in more statistical interpretations, where you just have one world afterwards, then you kind of get away with things. Okay, so. You typically get away with things. You know, one time I was driving and my car suddenly had a blowout, the back tire blew out and started swerving around, and I managed to pull over to safety and so I didn't die. In the minor worlds interpretation, I did die in some branches, and that would have been fine for me because I'd be dead, but it would have been very upsetting for all the people in those other worlds, maybe. So it really has a consequence for the way you think about your place in the world. Now, this is a bad criticism, because people who believe in the many worlds interpretation might just say, well, tough, that's the way the world is. But before you go as far as believing it, you might really want to be sure it's true. Certainly isolation from some horrible thing that's happening is no reason not to be horrified by it. Yeah. So the criticism really here is, it's good to understand what it's really telling you at a visceral level, and then take that into account whether you want to believe it or not. So yeah, like I say, people in many worlds interpretation might just say tough. In fact, exactly this has happened before in the history of physics. If you take the people used to believe that the Earth was at the center of the cosmos, and all the planets and the rest of the cosmos was evolving around it. And then that changed with Copernicus, and suddenly the Earth was just some incidental, we now think the Earth is just some incidental, system far away from, there's no any sense of center of the universe. And so it's a much less cozy picture. And yet science has forced us to that point of view. And you could say the same thing here, that science has forced us, if you believe this approach, to this many worlds point of view, and tough if it's distasteful. And the final criticism, and then I'll stop, is this approach may be unstable to progress in physics. You know, we have quantum theory isn't necessarily the final word. You know, in particular, we need to solve the problem of quantum gravity. And there are particular reasons in quantum gravity to think that that you may actually have something like wave function collapse. Okay, so unitarity, the very principle on which the many worlds gets its power, may end up going away when we make progress in physics. Okay, so those would be the criticisms I have of it. Okay, right. So I've gone over, but is there any questions or, yeah?
Your second point, is that saying that subjective reality has objective reality emergent from it?
My second, which one, sorry?
The middle board.
The middle board.
Is this saying something about objective reality?
No, I don't think it is. No, I think it's really just saying that you can coherently have subjective degrees of belief in your reasoning about the world. And that you can sort of have utility functions and probabilities and so on.
It's the fact that you have uniqueness in both of those parts.
Yeah, yeah. Is it saying... I don't think it is, but maybe people think about this might think that. Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Anything else? Have I scared you all sufficiently with the many worlds interpretation? Okay, great.